Good morning. Some very fine talks today. First, let me acknowledge my co-authors because when I heard Bill Kousis talk about the amount of resources required to pull off these experiments, my co-authors did a ton of that. I mean, thousands, literally thousands of neutron tube measurements for soil moisture. I mean, the amount of labor to pull off these 12-acre experiments is monumental, and I appreciate their help very much. So what I'd like to talk about in the next few minutes is something that's been bugging me about ET modeling for quite some time, and that is that we approach these as very deterministic models. We create the model, then we put the numbers, and we turn the crank, and out comes some answers. And then we say we'll compare that against some ground truth, and that's our analysis, and we put some error bars on that. And frankly, the ecologists have been doing a far better thing, at least for 20 years, to my knowledge, doing probabilistic modeling. And I think it's time that we need to consider that, too, here. So this is an illustration, and I'm certainly guilty of the same problem, is that we do these experiments here, shown in 2008, 2009, and 2011. We did some large field cotton experiments. And we did a surface energy balance approach. We looked at airborne and satellite data, and we compared the ET that we got out of a two-source energy balance model and a metric model used by Rick Allen and others against some soil moisture observation. We plot a one-to-one line, and we say, gee, we're doing fantastic. And then we do model intercomparison, and we draw some lines, and we get some regressions. And those are all very legitimate things to do. But I think the standard that surface energy balance and temperature radiometers have to be held to is a higher standard than we're applying it to, because we can already accomplish with Penn and Monteith maybe 80 or 90% of the accuracy we get. So I think the correct way to assess ET modeling accuracy is not just in the raw form, but to compare against what you would do if you had simpler observations, simpler modeling. For example, satellite data from visible near-infrared, getting a vegetation index is far easier, far less expensive to acquire than surface temperature data. In our lab, we've been conducting vegetation index-controlled crop coefficients for quite a few years. That's illustrated on the right-hand side there. There's just some experimental data. They're straight lines between observations, but what you see is the normal FAO 56 curve, that trapezoidal pattern, that's modified by earlier seasons, which are modified based on a vegetation index. We didn't know anything about the surface temperature. But those are validated ET estimates, and they gave us valid and quite accurate seasonal ET values. So why not use those as opposed to surface temperature observations? On the left-hand side, we show that we can do one-time soil texture modeling with the EM38 device on soil conductivity. So we can do some very simple things without getting into thermal infrared and get maybe 80, 90% of the way there. So why not do that? So I started thinking when I looked at the ecologist papers and how they do Bayesian analysis, I realized I think that they're onto something that we've been ignoring, and that is you never go at a problem in complete ignorance. You always bring some knowledge forward. Some problems have little prior knowledge, and some problems have a great deal of knowledge. And how do you incorporate that prior knowledge? Bayesian analysis, as we probably learned in sophomore year of college, is like you have a subjective prior probability to your estimates. In this case, it would be ET. And then you draw a probability distribution, and then you modify it based on observations. And it's been criticized in many forms because they say, well, this is very arbitrary. But in fact, if you look down and how that approach is done, it's not arbitrary at all when you put the prior probabilities. In this case, prior probability can be something like a standardized ET from ASCE. That's your prior knowledge, and we know that's actually pretty good. So what we want to do is test ET estimated by thermal infrared radiometry against something that's quite good already. And that's illustrated here, and the probability distributions on the left-hand side shows that what you start out would be the blue distribution. And you bring in observations, which could be from your surface temperatures, that would be in the green, and you combine the two. And what you get is that red distribution. What have you accomplished? You've reduced the bias of your original estimate from your standardized ET, and you've narrowed the confidence interval. That's a substantial accommodation. You use prior knowledge and new information into a summarized result. So at Maricopa, we've been doing these experiments, these ET experiments, at least since 2002, on small plots and in large plots in 4 years. These are 12-acre, 5-hectare plots, rather large, a great deal of labor effort. You can see in the lower right-hand side the current field experiment, which we call Field 13, where we put in reflectance tarps, and we fly airborne data over there on a weekly basis, so we monitor vegetation index and surface temperature. The experimental design is in the upper left here, just shows that we have different levels of irrigation treatment, some based on FAO 56, some based on surface energy balance, and others based on a vegetation index. And here's a close-up of that, and it just shows on the right-hand side how the thermal infrared can reveal problems with soil texture that have nothing to do with your experimental design. So surface observations are symbolized in this diagram here, which shows on the left-hand side the shortwave radiation you'd have from solar radiation observations, and the red would be your ideal solar radiation, and the blue would be as realized with cloudy conditions. On the right-hand side would be your thermal infrared data collected over time series, and I guess the first thing to note is the noisiness of those thermal data. So this is a modeling challenge. How do you handle very noisy data? And these aren't noisy because they're bad calibrations. It's because there's shadowing, there's peculiar orientations of your sensor. In a modeling framework with probabilistic, we can overcome some of those issues. So at the bottom we have the net result would be in surface energy balance, has been discussed in previous talks. So here's the approach we took in this study. The simplest possible way to do a Bayesian model is to use conjugate functions. There's quite nice software today available through R and Bugs software that you can get freely and available, and you can use complicated distribution functions. But what we want to do is start the simplest idea. So we assume normal conjugate pairs. We start with a prior ET, normally distributed, and a likelihood based on surface temperatures, also normally distributed, and it's a weighted average. Surface temperature really only contributes two things to the energy balance equation, long wave radiation and sensible heat flux. So it provides no additional information than shortwave radiation. For sensible heat flux, so this has been illustrated earlier today, on the upper right-hand side is your resistance equation. So what you're observing is T surface, this term here. But what you don't know very well is the resistance term. And that resistance term, as illustrated here, is a complicated function, but largely uncertain because of wind speed and then some stability corrections. But largely the variability is in the wind speed. So what we did is we simulated the variability uncertainty of wind speed from our weather data, as shown on the upper left. And we use a gamma distribution, which is appropriate distribution function for something like wind speed, which can obviously go less than zero. On the lower left shows you the corresponding simulation of your transport resistance, would be your comparable term in Penman-Monteith. And I think if you notice how highly variable it is, I mean, at nighttime, the resistance terms has low variability, and it doesn't have a smooth transition in the morning. It's abrupt. The conditions change very rapidly, and the uncertainty of that resistant term rapidly increases. This has to be incorporated in the surface energy balance. Same thing for the long wave radiation. There's some irony, too, and I meant to ask Rick about this point, too, is that the long wave radiation in the ASC standardized equation uses a Brunt formula, and if you look at the 1930 publications, he designed that for nighttime observations. And now you go to ASC and they say, oh, don't use this stuff at night. So there's some irony in the equations that we use that are quite good equations, but no longer applicable at nighttime. So how do we correct for that? Obviously, the thermal infrared data can provide us that information about the upwelling radiation It can't provide us too much about this the downwelling sky radiation unless you monitor that. Most of us don't do that, so we estimate it based on sky temperature. And so illustrated on the left is some simulations of the unknown of land surface temperature. We know what the accuracy of the radiometer is. We know what the accuracy of the air temperature sensors are, and we know some idea of the surface emissivity. We model those with simple surface distribution functions, normally distributed except for the emissivity, which is a beta function. And the result, as many things work out, is the net long wave radiation is very close to normally distributed. So what that illustrates is that when you do this for the Maricopa data, that the influence of your prior knowledge of net radiation, in this case would be the AOC equation, is rather large. Those net radiometers, infrared thermometers have a huge influence on your estimate of long wave radiation, as illustrated by the different probability distributions you see on the left, where you start with the blue and you have observations in green and the red is your outcome. So you changed a lot. On the other hand, for sensible heat flux, if you simulate or you estimate what the sensible heat flux would be based on a prior of ASE, it doesn't change that much. When this is an irrigated environment, the sensible heat flux is quite low. So the IRT, the infrared thermometer, in this particular study gave relatively little new information. Well, we really don't care so much about the individual energy components. We want to know the total daily evapotranspiration, and we can plot the probability distributions on a day-by-day basis. And that's illustrated on the left-hand side, where you can show the blue curves, which are the ASCE standardized ET probability distributions, and the red is what you get afterwards. And what it shows is a consistent decrease in confidence interval and a change in bias from day to day. If you look at the entire season for 2015, you compare the confidence interval, the standard deviation of the two distributions, you can see that the infrared thermometry reduces the confidence interval by up to a half, typical for most of the season. That's a substantial improvement using infrared thermometry. How does it look like on a seasonal basis when we correct for fractional cover? The red curve shows you the soil moisture neutron tube data and shows great variability that isn't recognized by the soil moisture data. That's the green and the blue. And you can see that the blue data is what you would get if you use ASCE ET. And a cumulative ET would be around 780 millimeters for the season, whereas a surface energy balance gives you 875. Which substantially increased in evaporation on water demand. When we look at modeling bias, we see that the surface energy balance also reduces estimation bias relative to soil moisture. So this is all quantified because we've used a Bayesian approach. So what I'm advocating here is that there's a need to incorporate multiple models when you do ET, not just turn the crank with one model, but have a framework so you can combine several models and then they can be penalized based on their certainty or uncertainty. In this case, we use a standardized ET for a prior, which worked very well. We use the thermo-infrared data because we knew that would work well for sensible heat flux estimation. We used normal distributions. That was quite adequate for this particular study, and we updated it. We updated the ET based on H and RL. I think the bottom line message is I think we need to start thinking about a probabilistic way of looking at models. This will allow us to do better forecasting as well as analyzing what has happened in the last few days of your estimation. Thank you very much. Yes.
Right. Then the surface temperature,
Why do I not use the aerodynamic surface temperature? Do we know what the aerodynamic surface temperature is? What we know is the surface temperature or that radiometer. That's the point. The point that I probably didn't emphasize enough is that you go with what you see. You don't go by what you could have seen, right? Which is the standard statistical way. So you go with the data, you observe it, and figure out from there if your evapotranspiration model makes sense.
Thank you, Andrew.
All right.